Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 10th of Sivan. Our response for today is from Shut Tzitz Eliezer by Rav Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, who was an important posek, important halachic decisor in Yerushalayim, particularly for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. This is from volume 19. There were like 25 or 26 volumes of Tzitz Eliezer that he published in his lifetime. Volume 19, Siman Bet, the second responsive. The question was sent to him on Erev Shavuos of Tafshin Nun of 5750, which would have been 1990, by Dr. Avraham S. Avraham, who's a well-known doctor and halachic authority on medical halachic issues. Tzitz Eliezer does a lot of medical halacha. We in this series, I want to be clear, I can't always control what comes up when, but I search for a spread of halachic issues. I try hard not to get stuck on any one particular set of issues. Many tshuvot, for example, many responses are about getting issues of how to write a get, or how to give a get, or how to coerce a get, or I try to avoid getting too caught up in those kinds of issues, and I also will certainly try to avoid getting too caught up in medical issues, although there are lots of different kinds of aspects to these kinds of issues. So in this case, for example, it's a monetary aspect, because they were discussing the question of who has to bear the monetary responsibility, the monetary cost of serving, of treating patients. So Dr. Avraham, in his question, wondered about the fact that Tzitz Eliezer had said to him in a previous conversation, or previous responsum, that lo ta'amod al dam re'acha, that the obligation not to stand by as a fellow is dying. The Ramah says that that creates an obligation to work to save somebody else, but not an obligation to spend money to save somebody else. And the Tzitz Eliezer seem to have ruled that way, that we are not obligated, other than in tzedaka terms, and we'll get to tzedaka in a minute, but we are not, by virtue of the obligation to save somebody else's life, we are not. That does not include a financial component. Another example of a similar kind of halacha is when it comes to kibbut av va'em, so honoring a father and a mother, a parent. So colloquially, we think that means honor, like treat them well and be nice to them. Halachically, it has specific expressions. One has to clothe a parent and feed a parent and arrange for the parent to get out if they want to get out and get in if they want to get in, or do it oneself, and to give them clothing and shoes. But the halacha is that the monetary cost of that is to be borne by the parent. The obligation of the child isn't to pay for those things, it's to arrange for them to happen, to make sure that once they're paid for, they actually happen. So that's another example where you can have a halachic. Now, there too, it doesn't mean the child shouldn't do it if the parent doesn't have money, and that'll come up in our discussion today, but it means that the primary financial responsibility is not the child's, it's the parent's. Here too, the Tzitz Eliezer had said the primary financial responsibility for medical care or for saving a person's life is not in the people who witness it, it's in the person themselves. Dr. Avraham was asking because he had seen a rush on Sanhedrin which says, "V'hanitzol chayav lifroa," that if somebody is saving somebody else, the person who got saved has to pay back the expenses of the person who had saved him or her. He has to pay back with his own money. While that, and that is cited by the Kesef Mishnah in his commentary on the Rambam, and the Chavot Yair was an important halachic authority of the 17th century, I'm pretty sure, of the 17th century. In Kuf Mem Vav, it also said, everybody agrees that the person who's saving somebody else would have to lay out the money on his own. He would have to, you need to rent a car to drive the person to the hospital, if you have a car service, whatever you have to do, whatever money has to be spent, that the person doing the saving would spend the money, and then the person who got saved has to pay it back. But the implication that Dr. Avraham says is, the implication is that he has to lay out the money, and then he'll get it back from the person who got saved. And if he doesn't have money to pay it back, let's say the person who got saved is too impoverished to pay it back, it sounds like he has to lay out the money and pay it. That's the way he understands it, Dr. Avraham. He apologizes for raising the question again, but he feels like he hasn't understood it, and it's Torah, and he needs to understand it. So on the 10th of Sivan, 5 days later, Tzitz Eliezer answers the question. He says, the truth is, if you look carefully at the Rush, what the Rush mostly cared about, what the Rush was interested in letting us know, was that the person doing the saving does not have to save the person from his own money, because that's what he's focused on. And because the Rosh's proof was from a Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Ayin Dalet. Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Ayin Dalet is talking about a different situation. Let's say one person is chasing another person. Okay, so you have a potential victim, potential murderer, and the victim, as he's running away, breaks somebody else's property, damages somebody else's property. So a simple example would be, so-and-so is being chased, jumps into a car to flee, and the person's chasing after him in a car as well, and while he's driving away, he slams into somebody else's car and damages it in some way, and then he goes off and he gets saved, and whatever it is. The Gemara says that potential victim has to pay back the person whose property was damaged. And the Rosh says, well, if the person's property was damaged, was required to use his own money to save that person, then breaking their property shouldn't be an issue because they should have paid for it anyway. In other words, let's put names on it, right? If Jack is the potential victim and he damages John's property or Reuven and Yaakov, whatever names you want to use, we always use Reuven and Shimon, right? Reuven is running away, Reuven is in trouble, and he damages Shimon's property. If we generally assume that Shimon has to pay money to save Reuven's life, then Reuven should be patur. He should be free of that obligation. So if the fact that the Gemara says that Reuven has to pay it back shows that, in fact, Shimon is not required to pay for it. We'll go on to this in a second, but that's the fundamental proof that the Rosh is giving. So therefore, the Rosh is really concerned with showing that Shimon is not fundamentally obligated to pay money. What that has to do with laying out the money and being paid back, we'll see in a second. But it means that the financial responsibility for saving somebody's life lies with the person themselves, not with other people around. And that's why the Gemara will say that you have to pay them back. This comes up, by the way, in lots of other cases that people come up with. So, for example, there used to be a famous moral dilemma. I think the guy's name was Heinz, right? If Heinz's wife is ill and there's medicine, but Heinz doesn't have the money for the medicine, can Heinz break into a pharmacy and take the medicine and just steal the medicine? So that was like a moral dilemma that came up. So part of the answer in halacha depends on this question here of whose responsibility it is to save other people's lives if people are at risk of death. And the Rosh is pointing out that the Gemara seems to say the financial element of it lies with the person who is in danger of being killed or being passed away. And the Rosh's reason, now getting back to the Rosh, and let's do this, was Mish Ein Adam Mechuyav Lahatzil B'Mamono Heicha De'itlei Mamono LaNitzol. That the person saving somebody else doesn't have to pay money where the person being saved has the money for it. But you might say, well, but it sounds like if the potential victim or the patient doesn't have the money, that maybe other people do have the obligation. So he says, well, I think that's probably true, as Tozer says, but it's true not in the sense of an obligation, a blanket obligation to save other people's lives, meaning when it comes to violating Shabbos, we do whatever it takes to save somebody else's life. When it comes to violating any prohibition in the Torah, we do whatever it takes to save somebody else's life. So the halacha says that when it comes to saving somebody, they have to pay for it, but if they don't have the money, we pay for it, you might think it means in that same broad and unlimited sense. So this says no. He thinks at that point, our general halacha would kick in that when it comes to obligations, we generally don't think that we have to pay more than a fifth of our possessions, a fifth of our property, a fifth of our whatever, in order to fulfill these mitzvot. So then that's true about any mitzvah aseh. So when it comes to mitzvah aseh, if it's very expensive, we're not required to give more than a fifth of our property to fulfill it. That gets into complicated questions of, you know, how much we have to pay for a little of an etrog, how much for this or that. So it comes up in halacha in a couple of other contexts as well, not only in this one. But the point being, though, Chiddush, the Tzitzler says, hey, Shehava Amin, I would have thought that I'm only required to use the victim or the patient's money, right, which is what the Chavar Yar thought maybe was true. And then it turns out, and then when we turn to Kibbutz Av, that you only have to give from the father's, from the parent's money as well. So therefore, it turns out that the person will have to pay something as well, but no more than a fifth. Now, when it comes to saying that, that would seem to imply that society, which has many, many people who need saving in various ways, wouldn't have to give more than a fifth of its money to do so, and particular people, particular individuals, wouldn't have to give more than a fifth of their money in order to support all of these causes. And then that becomes complicated because is it every particular person, or if I know that I have a whole society out there and they all need money, how can I do with it? But sticking with his Eliezer, he's going to point out that the Rosh seems very clear about this in other places where the Rosh says it more clearly. For example, there's a Tosfos of Rosh where he says, one is not allowed to save oneself with somebody else's money. And by that we mean not that you're not allowed to do it, right? What we mean is, there's actually a Rashi in Bava Kamma, I think I once learned many years ago, that seems to imply that, but we don't think it means that. We mean that the person will save one of them their lives, but then they owe the money back. So you might have thought they don't owe it at all because the other person, so, right? If Heinz is going to break into the pharmacy, steal the medicine, you might have thought that Heinz isn't required to pay anything back because it was for saving somebody's life. So the answer is no. Heinz would have to be required to pay back the cost of the break-in and the cost of the medication. It's just that he's allowed to do it, but he's not allowed to do it by causing financial loss to the other person. He would have to pay that back. Now, that does sound, though, however, as if the other people have no obligation whatsoever. Because if they had an obligation, we would say, well, then that's part of their obligation. So the answer is no. We also think that if somebody sees somebody else who's in need of assistance, that the other people are required to make the effort to hire whatever needs to be hired. So, for example, let's say it would take shipping the medication. And Heinz or his wife, wherever it is too ill to arrange for the shipping of the medication, or arranges calling for an ambulance, or getting a doctor to come, whatever it is. All of those kinds of things are part of the obligation of others. They're obligated to put in the effort to do so, and they're obligated to lay out the money. And what's the point being, not that, the point is that you might have thought at either extreme, you might have thought that the other people are completely implicated, such that they have to pay all the money. That's not true. But then you might have thought that they're also completely non-implicated, and that since the money has to come from the potential victim or the patient or whoever it is, so too all the effort does as well. And that's not true either. What the Rosh is trying to say is that it's in the middle, that his point is that it's not the money of the other people that needs to be given in. It's really the money of the patient, if that money is there. But that the other people do have the obligation to put out the effort and make the attempts to save that person's life, and even to lay out the money, which I'm not obligated to pay for somebody's medical care, I might have thought that I'm also not obligated to lay out the money and then have to go collect it, because that can sometimes be a challenge and a problem. And the answer in the Rosh and the Chavos Yair is that no, that the other people have to lay out the money if necessary, and then they can worry about getting it back later. And so that's the fundamental answer that's coming on this question. One last little piece of it is that if I might have thought that the person would not be obligated to lay out the money, when I say they are obligated to lay out the money, then there's a thing that still doesn't fall, and it's to avoid violating a prohibition of lo ta'amor adam re'echa. But the Tzitzit understands the Chavot Yair to be saying that that obligation still is more like an aseh, in that it's no more than a fifth. And this becomes an issue certainly in times when there are medical costs that are extensive, and if there are people who don't have insurance or their insurance doesn't cover it and they come to us, so that becomes a question for how much we are obligated to kick in for those kinds of causes. And the Tzitzit is saying it's not fundamentally our financial obligation to make sure these people are taken care of. It's our financial obligation not to be omeid al dam re'acha, but that, as far as he seems to be saying, only goes up to a fifth of our property, of our possessions. And I think he means that can be done on a broader social scale. But you know, if person X comes to me and is in trouble, so it could be that I can go to other people, I can try to raise money, or I can have them to raise money and this and this and this, but it gets to be a complicated financial question because these costs can certainly be extensive. Fundamentally, the costs really rest on the person who's in trouble, but other people have the obligation not to be omeid adam re'acha, not to stand by and watch somebody pass away without trying to help, and that's an obligation that extends up to a fifth of their possessions. That's the answer to that question as far as Tzitzil is concerned. He then turns, it's called Bishulei HaTshuva, he has a postscript. And it's an interesting postscript to me for a couple of reasons, but one reason is because it shows that the discussion of halacha between these men didn't stick to medical issues, didn't stick to the issue at hand. They had many conversations about many issues, because the question that comes up in the end of the tshuva is that when they met one time, Dr. Avraham had asked that since they asked about a Gemara in Yevamot. The Gemara in Yevamot and Daf Samach Bet had wanted to prove that non-Jews have chayis. So chayis means that we assume that the father of a son is in fact his father and grandfather, and that connection through the patrilineal line, through the lineage, has meaning. Meaning, there's a concept in the Gemara that an eved ein lo chayis. When eved ein lo chayis means that if a slave has a child, halachically, that child doesn't really have any connection to the halachic father. And that's not a question of we don't trust that that's really the father. It's a question of that yichus, for whatever lineage matters, doesn't apply to avadim, doesn't apply to slaves by virtue of their social status, by virtue of the fact that they are owned by others. With non-Jews, you could have imagined the halacha would have said they too have no chayas. So the Gemara in Yevamot says it's not true. We do think they have chayas. And where did the Gemara get that from? There's a pasuk in Malachim Aleph. No, in Malachim Bet, I think. In Malachim Bet, when it says, Ba'etahi shalach brodach baladan ben baladan. Right? There was a king, a non-Jewish king, who sent a message, brodach baladan ben baladan. Mufarish Rashi, Alma banim mikra. Rashi, the Gemara says, from the fact that Rashi seems to say, that from the fact that scripture refers to this Brodach Baladan as the son of Baladan, it sounds like what we're saying is, see, and this connection, this father-son connection, applies to non-Jews just like it applies to Jews, and there's such a thing as chayis as yichus. Otherwise, the Lamaloi, Dr. Avraham wanted to know, if that's the proof, then why didn't they bring the proof from the Torah, where the Torah refers to Bil'am as Bil'am ben Be'or? So if the proof is that the Torah is willing to accept, Tanakh is willing to accept, that non-Jews have fathers and that we ascribe the child to the father, we have an example in the Torah itself. Why reach for Malachim, right? So Tzitzil says, when he got home, Matzati she'amad al kach b'chela gimel b'kuntris tosefet habikurim. He says, I found that in the third part of this little notebook called Tosefet HaBichurim, which I don't know it, I haven't heard of it, I don't know what the book is, and it's an example, it's part of what struck me about this part of the Tshuva. Tzitzil doesn't really mean he found it there, right? And you don't just randomly go to your shelf, find a book called Tosefet HaBichurim, I think it's HaBichurim and HaBichurim, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's HaBichurim. You find a book and then you pull it off the shelf and you happen to get to the third part of it, and then, oh, I found out the answer to your question. It means Tzitzil had read this book already sometime before. He had a vague memory that it was. He went and he looked for it. It's an example of, there are many examples of it, an example of the breadth, the remarkable breadth of the library that the Tzitzil Eliezer, and there are others of that time as well. Rav Elazar Yosef was also from that time. There were these people who grew up in Yerushalayim in the early to mid-1900s, and they had this remarkable library of books that they were reading and learning and memorizing and keeping in mind, and this is an example of it. So you have this book that I really don't know it's so famous, but maybe that's an example of my ignorance rather than the fact that it's not such a famous book. But he says there, he had an answer to this question. He says that when the Torah refers to Bil'am as Ben Be'or, it doesn't mean to say that there's necessarily a yichus issue there. It doesn't mean to say that they're in fact connected halachically. It might just be a way of identifying Bil'am better. Or if it says Lavan ben Bituel, another example. Right? It's possible there was another Lavan, there's another Bil'am, and since people knew this person by the name of his father, the Torah gave you the name of the father, not as a declaration of exact lineage, but just because they want to be able to identify it. But in our case, with this Mirodach, whose second name, Baladan, already well identified him, because you can imagine there being another Mirodach out there, but the odds that there was another Mirodach, Baladan, out there was highly unlikely. So the fact that his second name, which was also his father's name, but the second name told you who he was, and yet, the Torah, the Tanakh, added Ben Baladan, that's why it's approved. Meaning, there's two functions that a father's name can fulfill. It can fulfill an identifying function, and it can fulfill a lineage function. So the Tosefta Bikurim's point was that in most cases, you can't be sure that the father's name wasn't just fulfilling an identifying function. But in the case of Muradach Baladan, you're able to see that for sure. Tzitzeliezer adds that he thinks he saw a similar idea in the Ritva already, where the Ritva had said that the proof wasn't from the fact that it specified the son of who he was. It was from the fact that his name had Baladan in it already. And so Tzitzeliezer thinks that's very similar. That's because the Torah didn't just say, the Tanakh didn't just say, Merodach ben Baladan, but it gave you the Merodach Baladan ben Baladan. So that's the proof from the grouping of all those together, because it did. So that's the end of the Tshuva and the Tzitzeliezer that we have for today. The main question being the question of who's responsible financially. Because after all, when it comes to saving a life, there's the saving a life part of it, and then there's the cost part of it. Who's responsible for the cost part of it? We could have imagined somebody saying, well, everybody's responsible, and if the person, and therefore everybody has to pay. Or you can imagine somebody saying, well, the primary responsibility is upon the patient. If the patient doesn't have it, then everybody has to step in. And Eliezer understands the halacha to say that for the patient, it's a responsibility. That's where the financial responsibility lies. The patient can't take care of it. That becomes more like a general tzedakah issue. In this case, it would be more like a question of avoiding the problem of lo tamud al dam re'echa, avoiding the problem of standing by while other people pass away. The financial element of that is similar to other mitzvot aseh, other positive commandments in the Torah, where the obligation is that we have to do up to a fifth of our assets, which could be a significant burden, but up to a fifth and no more than that. So if, and in addition, there's a requirement to lay out the money for the person, which wouldn't necessarily have been true, but there's a requirement to lay out the money for the person and then collect it afterwards if the person is not in a position at the time to do it. Secondarily, at the end of the tshuva, the Tzitzeliezer had included a discussion of yichus by non-Jews, just an example of the way Talmidei Chachamim, when they speak with each other, don't speak only about the issue at hand, they speak about halachic issues that come up or interesting Gemara issues that come up, and this is an example of that kind of discussion. The proof from Merodach Baladan ben Baladan as to whether or not non-Jews have yichus. Have a good day.